Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Where did you go travelling this week, Mark?
Geelong.
Geelong?
I know.
What's going on down in Geelong by the sea?
Well, I went down to Geelong and I got Joy the whole way, which was great. I was listening to Joy, and it's not often that you can listen to a broadcast from Joy all the way down the Bellarine.
So it must have been a clear day.
It was. It was quite a good day. And it was only until I hit the Geelong Hallmaker Centre that I lost radio signal. So that was great to know that Joy's reach is around the bay. So, yeah, it was great. And not a lot of travel for me this week, although my brother and his partner have come over from Adelaide. So
that's kind of neat. They've come over from Adelaide and we've sent Pete to Adelaide.
So I know.
Does that kind of like balance
program.
It up? Yeah. At any given time.
Cultural exchange program.
Yeah, we have to be in balance.
Mm. So not a lot of travel apart from public transport for me. And this week, for some reason, all the trams seem so much better. I'm on one of the lines that's recently been upgraded. So instead of having to try and jimmy yourself onto a tram in the morning, it seems like they've done a lot of work at getting larger trams on. I don't think they're any more frequent, but I think they pick up more people as they go along. And the trams are notably larger on the 67 line to St Kilda, and it's made a huge difference.
Oh, wow. Nice. So you've got those nice big trams that we have on, like, Route 96, etc.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it was one of the older tram lines, and I think it was Carlisle Street that has recently been upgraded. No, that would be the three. Anyway, something has been upgraded because there are bigger trams and it's...
And it's school holidays as well. And it's also been Jewish holidays this week.
Yeah, Rosh Hashanah.
Too.
Yeah, so Shana Tova to our Hebrew friends.
Indeed. So it has been probably a few less people trying to get on the tram too.
Yeah, bigger trams, fewer people, and it all works out very well. So, Joe, what did you go? Where did you trot around to?
Well, I did go to Trentham on Sunday, which was rather delightful, actually, just to get out of the CBD and see what's happening in regional Victoria. And Wednesday night, I took a virtual tour to Paris while I was watching La Traviata with the Melbourne Opera Company, Victorian Opera Company, sorry, here at the Athenaeum Theatre, which was quite delightful. It really is a charming opera, La Traviata, and I think it's still playing. So if anybody would feels like they'd like some culture with a K, they can definitely pop along to La Traviata.
I saw the Australian version, which was La Traviata.
La Traviata. Oh, that sounds most interesting. What happens in La Traviata?
They go, "Oi, Trev."
I obviously walked straight into that one.
Yeah.
I don't even want to find out how long he dies in Act 4.
That was so lame.
Yeah. But what is anything but lame is our guest on today's program on the Escape Pod. We had the amazing pleasure to interview Tim Cope. Now, some of you might have seen Tim's adventure travel series that was aired on the ABC. I think earlier this year, where he takes the trails of Genghis Khan and he travels from Mongolia all the way through to Hungary. Tim not only did a series where he actually did his own filming the entire way, but he also has written a book which has just been released by Bloomsbury, and it is called On the Trail of Genghis Khan. It's a magnificent read. I won't lie to you, it's a long read, so I would really encourage you perhaps to even try the ebook version.
It's a long story, though. It's 4 years and it's very dense experiences, but there are pictures, but we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, we will indeed.
Guess what?
What?
Tim's here.
Excellent. Well, let's throw to Tim.
Joe, today we've got a really special guest. Who is our guest today?
Yes, today we've got Tim Cope. He's an Australian adventurer extraordinaire. He's done everything from tour with recumbent bicycles to horses to dogs, you name it. If it's got anything to do with Mongolia and the trails of Genghis Khan, Tim's done it.
Mongolia?
Mongolia, absolutely. That place where we all think we're going to be banished to, the steppes of Outer Mongolia, are actually something that Tim finds incredibly fascinating.
Now, I was watching Xanadu the other weekend. Is there any correlation?
To spandex leg warmers Lycra.
Kublai Khan.
Oh, I'm with you. Right, I missed that completely.
Actually, probably a better question for our guest.
I think it is. Tim, why are you fascinated with Mongolia?
The first time I was there, I was just awestruck. My friend Chris and I, we'd been spending 12 months at that stage riding bikes across Russia and Siberia on the way to China, and I'd become totally entranced by Russia, this great, big, vast country, the tiger forest and the tundra in the north and the plains in the south. And yet when we arrived in Mongolia, it was altogether something new, and I was even more dumbstruck. These horsemen would just come galloping out of nowhere. They'd say hello and then gallop off, it seemed, to wherever they wanted to, leaving us kind of pushing our bikes through the Gobi Sands along these miserable tracks that had a predetermined path. Until that point, I was 21 at the time, the bikes had been a tool for us to kind of break away from a conventional path in life, you know, follow our dreams of adventure. But suddenly it felt as if actually we were just wimpy tourists pushing along these tracks that couldn't take us to where I wanted to go. And these people, the nomads in Mongolia, live in a world where there are no fences, there's no such thing as private property. They move with the seasons, with their animals. It's minus 50 in winter, plus 50 in summer, and they live in felt tents known as gurs or yurts. And I wanted to know more about these people and what it was like to live their life.
So it really is, it's also what we consider to be the home of the horse as we know it, isn't it? I mean, that's where horses originated from, in the steppes of Mongolia. But when you say there's no ownership of land, the Soviets did attempt, did they not, to put some boundaries?
Absolutely. I mean, the steppe, when Genghis Khan proclaimed his empire in 1206, he proclaimed himself to be the ruler of all those people who live in felt tents, which at the time would have, you know, was a massive swath of land, basically the whole Eurasian steppe stretching from Mongolia 10,000 kilometres to Europe. Back then it was one big open landscape where you had conflict between tribes and so forth, but essentially it was one geographical region. Now it's been broken into the various states. It went through the Russian colonisation process in the 19th century, and then in the 20th century along came the Soviets and Stalin. Mongolia was kind of spared the harshest realities of Stalin's industrialisation campaign in the 20s and 30s, but at the core of the Eurasian steppe is Kazakhstan, and that's a country where I really experienced a place that was still recovering from the trauma of what occurred in the 30s. About one third of the population, about 2 million nomads, starved to death,
which is just horrific. We think about what happens in North Korea today, but it has happened before, and this was an example.
Yeah, well, this was a real push to settle nomads. I mean, the problem with nomads that governments have is that they're very self-reliant, they don't really obey authority, and they're not very good for a consumer society because they've got everything for themselves. And so Stalin's program required all the nomads to settle in villages and collective farms. Their animals were taken away, everything was basically confiscated by the state. And people starved to death, about one third, as I mentioned. And over the next 60, 70 years, the Kazakhs had no choice but to adapt to this Soviet system, this Soviet mentality, only for it to, of course, collapse in 1990, to leave them without their traditional kind of structure of life, but also without the Soviet system that had supported them in a way. And
so they were stuck in a no-man's land, weren't they, then?
Sorry?
They were bereft. They were just left with these cities that were designed to just create the one commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously was destroyed in the 1990s, and yet they didn't have their cultural background to fall back on because there'd been too many generations in between.
That's right, yeah.
And so how decimated is the culture, the indigenous culture, and from where it is today? And is there any hope of rebuilding it, like Hebrew was rebuilt as a legitimate language?
Yeah, it's a very complex question. It took me about 4 years to write a book about this journey. So
we're going to have to read the book.
but in a nutshell, I guess there is, because there are only one, two, three generations from the saddle from a life following the seasons, much like most Mongolians still live today. They inherently know their culture and their history. The problem is that in the 90s, about 80% of the animals disappeared. Mm. So you have all of these village communities where they don't have enough animals to justify going out and finding grass and finding pasture and migrating from place to place like their ancestors. They're kind of like dormant nomads living in their towns, singing on the traditional instrument like the dombra, these old melancholic songs about what once was. And the few nomadic families that do exist are kind of envied because they're rich enough to have enough animals to get out there and move and live that life. On the other hand, I mean, Kazakhstan's a place like Australia in many ways, with a two-speed economy. You've got the massive oil boom. I mean, some of the biggest finds in history in the last 20, 30 years were in the Caspian region of Kazakhstan. And I rode for many months along, actually, the oil pipeline, visiting nomads, but next to this big, horrible thing that was pumping millions of barrels of oil to the west. And these two kind of... these two worlds that rough juncture between...
Asymmetrical.
Yeah.
Very asymmetrical.
It's incongruent and it's a real juxtaposition, isn't it? Because you've got a modern man-made pipeline that is carrying riches away from these very people, for whom just a little bit of that currency would enable them to establish herds and perhaps reconnect with their indigenous culture.
But like we're experiencing in Mongolia already, it's really the marginalisation of the nomad economy that the oil and the mining and so forth, where it has the greatest effect. And basically, people's values start to change, and they start to aspire to a job in the oil fields rather than to their traditional values of, a big herd of sheep or camels and horses.
If you can hear that wondrous noise in the background, I think it's time to introduce someone else we have in the studio.
Oh yes, I forgot. We have our second guest.
The ultimate souvenir.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about Tigon.
So, just to give you a bit of context, I set off with this dream of having two pack horses and a riding horse, and to ride 10,000 k's across the Eurasian steppe to Hungary. And I couldn't ride a horse before I began this, so I was quite green, to say the least. In fact,
it's quite audacious, really.
Riding out of Hutter Horden, there was this big crowd arrived to see me off, and I actually couldn't get up into the saddle. And when I did, the horse was spinning around, and my bum went up, and my head went down to the mane, and I ended up having to walk out of town, to the beginning of this trip. But about 6 months in, we were heading into the first winter, and this guy I set in Kazakhstan travelled with me for 10 days, and he said, "Tim, you definitely need a friend on this long road, someone to protect you from the wolves and keep you warm at night." And that's when he he presented me with this little pup called Tigon. And Tigon, at that stage, was a scrawny little runt that was leaping off the snow onto my shoulders just to get his paws out of the cold.
He doesn't like getting his paws cold, does he?
No, I used to paint vodka on them to stop the frostbite, and I used to put him inside a big canvas bag at night to keep him warm, and the canvas bag used to start hopping towards the stove at night when dinner started to boil. But Tigon grew into this beautiful big dog without whom I simply couldn't have survived. And for the next 3 years, it was Tigon and I and my three horses to the Danube River.
How did you get him into the country, into Australia?
Long process. It took 1 year. He was a Kazakh dog, so he wasn't allowed directly into Australia. He had to become naturalised as a Hungarian and get an EU passport. And then we were able to apply for an AQUIS permit. And then we went through that long process. And finally, one day, he arrived on a plane from Dubai to Melbourne. And he's since developed a really good taste for Australian rabbits. Foxes.
Because I can't see him eating goulash as a naturalised Hungarian, but you never know your luck. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Joy 94.9 on the Escape Pod. Tim, your recent book, On the Trail of Genghis Khan, your trail was from Mongolia to Hungary, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So what is the mindset that you need to have as an adventure traveller? Because a lot of people listening travel frequently, but perhaps not quite as an adventurer the way you do.
I think, first of all, you have to be very passionate about what you want to do and experience, because it's certainly not a holiday.
No, it's anything but.
It's a very difficult kind of challenge. I think, most importantly, you have to have a very open mind and you have to be able to, on my journey, kind of leave, I had to leave my excess baggage behind as a Westerner, as an Australian, and try to adapt to their ways. I mean, in the fifth day of the trip, I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I couldn't hear my horses grazing. Next thing I heard was this snigger and horses galloping off into the night, and of course leapt out to find they'd been stolen. This was the beginning of one of many, many horse rustling episodes in my journey, and luckily I was able to find them a 2 hours ride away, where this guy told me this wonderful Mongolian proverb, which is that a man on the steppe without friends is as narrow as a finger, and a man on the steppe with friends is as wide as the steppe. And that was the first of one of many lessons, when I had to start learning about the local ways. And of course, if I camp with the people, then they give me protection and not see me as fair game. Also, kind of heading off into this adventure, I realised how vulnerable I was. And you have to make yourself vulnerable in order to learn these new things.
But you went without a gun. And that's something that I, as I was reading your book, I was amazed. Why did you not want to have the protection of a firearm?
It never occurred to me that I'd need one, to be honest. And also, I don't know how to use a gun.
You didn't know how to ride a horse either, but you went off with four horses and a dog, but without any means of protection such as a gun for wolves and horse rustlers.
Yeah, about 2 weeks into the trip, I realised that warnings about the wolves should be listened to. A pack of wolves came in one night. I got the fire going, urinated around camp, as the equine vet had told me to do. They came within 50-100 metres.
Must have been frightening.
Dear.
The horses were kind of trembling and wanting to escape. And
were you trembling and wanting to escape? I'm trembling and wanting to escape. I'm in Melbourne.
At that point, I was, actually. I'd never really... I'd read a lot about wolves and that they very rarely ever attack humans, but it wasn't the point. My horses were conveniently bound with hobbles and ropes around my tent, and of course that's what the wolves were interested in. After that point, I decided to carry firecrackers that I used to throw out the tent door at night on a regular basis, just to keep them at bay, and that seemed to work.
And how long did you keep your tent for? Because I was fascinated to read how there were times there it was almost falling apart and you'd have to stop and make repairs. Did you manage to keep the same tent?
No, I went through three tents and about 13 horses, in fact.
Because you did have a break, didn't you, during the trip where you mm-hmm. were called to London to accept an award, is that right?
Yeah, there was three breaks from the trip. One was I was in Kazakhstan. At that point, I became trapped in this terrible kind of bankrupt gold mining village where these two alcoholic, right, Trisha and Vidker had invited me in and fed me a boiled pigeon for breakfast, for Christmas.
And these were the people that were actually trying to steal gold from the mines,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, I was a very difficult place. It's one of those cities that you were relating to earlier, built during Soviet times, called a Monogorod, so a city based around one exclusive industry that had all kind of collapsed, and people were shimmying down 400-metre shafts to steal gold from the state mine and then sell on the black market.
Wow.
And, Tigan was stolen in that place and almost eaten. People were catching stray dogs and pet dogs to eat to survive.
And the person who was sort of your protector in that village actually had to go and get Tigan back, didn't he?
Yeah, Baidark saved him. In the meantime, his pet dog was stolen and eaten.
Oh.
And
sometimes we think we're having a bad hair day.
Tigan was revived.
Really puts it into context.
Tigan was revived with raw eggs and vodka during that.
Aren't we all?
It was, I'm sure. And particularly the vodka on my trip. But at that stage, I ended up getting stuck for 3 months, and I had an opportunity to go to London to be inducted as a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society. And I went across for about a week, came back and continued. And these breaks, to start with, I was a bit reluctant to go on them, but in the end, this trip took 3.5 years. It had to encompass everything in my life, and some of them were not forced on me. They just happened. Some of them were forced, I should say. When I was 3/4 of the way through the journey, I was riding along and a beeping came in my backpack. I stopped, got out my satellite phone and realised I left it on. A message had come for me to call home. So I called home, and that's when I discovered that my father had been killed in a car accident in Gippsland in Victoria. And the journey kind of came to an end right there and then for me. I went home. I spent 4.5 months just dealing with that as the oldest of four kids.
Your dad was a renowned educator, wasn't he?
Yeah, he set up the Bachelor of Sport and Outdoor Recreation in Gippsland. So I grew up as a kid from an early age, being out in the wilderness, in the bush, on the coast, and I guess that seeded my, in some ways, my interest and curiosity in adventure and going beyond the horizon.
That's a really interesting point. So you had outdoorsy Australian experience and then this amazing experience on the trail of Genghis Khan. How did London confront you? Did you take in your stride or after being on horseback?
Oh, no. It reached a point on my trip where I realised I probably could never live in a city again. The last 4 years writing the book, I've been up in Toowoonga, in Australia's north, in Victoria's northeast, near the mountains. The city appeared, I guess by that stage of the trip, I was already beginning to view the world very much through a horse's eyes. So I was looking for grass, looking for water, looking for open space, looking for room to roam. And here was this place where, I remember getting on the train from the airport from Heathrow into the city and looking down, and at least along this edge of the train tracks, there was some great grass.
I bet you're the first that's ever only, put that together.
That was the only softness, the only kindness that this environment seemed to be offering for someone who was attuned, you know, to looking for space and water and grass. It's hard to describe, but after many months and years on a horse, roads, cities, trucks, cars, steel, concrete, it appears very violent, you know, and more dangerous than the wolves or thieves or even the minus 50 blizzards and everything else. Yeah.
Wow. You don't even think in those terms, do you, when you're acclimatised to an urban environment, how rigid and hard and structured and cold. Interesting.
Yeah, and in fact, that was one of my questions that I had for today for Tim, was how you actually adjust to an urban landscape and the typical first world problems that we have. And it sounds as though after the experience that you've had on the steps and your travels from one side of Eurasia to the other, you don't really readjust. You're now forever changed.
There's no way. There's no turning back after that kind of experience. You can never see the world the way you did beforehand. I guess the way that I've adapted mostly psychologically has been writing the book, a way of figuring out and digesting what I experienced and what among that is relatable and applicable here in Australia. Getting Tig and my dog back to Australia kind of helped bridge that gap as well. I go back to Mongolia every year, and in fact my partner's Mongolian. So I have managed to bridge it in some ways, but I'll never forget one of the first Sundays when I moved up here, there was a big knocking on the window on the door, and this guy said, you know, I'm going to call the sheriff because your dog's trespassed on my property. And that was a big shock, because that's a very different mentality. That could never happen out there on the steppe.
So you've not only written the book about your latest journey, but am I correct in saying that there's a television series, and that you're also, from a traveller's perspective, actually conducting tours through part of Mongolia, is that right?
Yeah, I filmed all the journey myself, came back, spent 2 years making a series that was shown on the ABC and in Europe, which was a wonderful experience in itself, and spent 4 years writing the book. And in 2009, I returned to Mongolia to take a group for an 18-day trek in the west. In fact, I revisited the same guy who'd travelled with me over some big mountain passes, Dashnyam. And I'd given Dashnyam a horse as a gift, and I turned up hoping
had
to see...
Had he kept the happen. Horse?
Well, I asked him quite excited, you know, where is this new horse? He said, oh, unfortunately, we ate it last winter, so...
What do you eat a horse with? Horseradish. On that thought, just stick with us on Joy 94.9. This is the Escape Pod.
Now, you're listening to the Escape Pod on Joy 94.9. As you know, we are a community radio station, and we love it when people join up with membership. From $96 for a family, $72 for an individual, concession is $36, under 18 is $22, and businesses are $165. You can even join up the pets in your family. So please give us a call on 1300-JOY-949 or go onto our website at www.joy.org.au and sign up. Keep supporting Joy so that we can be on air for our community.
It's 23 minutes to 3. You're in Joy 94.9. This is the Escape Pod with Joe and Mark. What we have is another question for Tim, who has recently written a book called On the Trail of Genghis Khan. We've been talking about a bunch of different things that he did when he was in Mongolia. But Tim, what was the thing that struck you when you got home? How did you adjust? What was the first thing? We were talking about that just before we had a quick break.
I was struck on one of the things I remember, actually, was walking along the road near my mum's house in Gippsland and realising that I couldn't get to those hills in the distance in a straight line. You know, in our society, at least in Gippsland, the land is kind of parcelled up into little farms and fences and roads, and suddenly the roads felt like shackles on the land, totally inhibiting any kind of freedom of movement. That was one of the first experiences I had. I remember waking up very disoriented in a room with walls. I felt very... I guess during the journey, I grew so accustomed to living in my tent, which was like the nucleus of my little family. I had three horses grazing around it. I had my dog. Obviously, the tent's walls are very thin, so you can hear everything that's going on. In a house where things are kind of a little bit more soundproofed and insulated, I felt quite trapped and separated from what was going on outside. I woke up in the morning and realised I didn't know anything that had gone on during the night. Somehow out there, your one eye is always open or one ear is always open, and you know everything that's going on. You become attuned to, even if in winter, I remember, if the day contracts by 1 minute, you notice it. The day's shorter. You notice every little weather change, you know, how the grass changes. And we kind of, it's like getting a broken up story living in a house or in a town or a city. In a city, you kind of don't even know what the story is in some ways with what's going on with the rhythms of the land.
So you've compiled all this in a rather a hefty tome. What a fascinating book. Joe, you've read the book from cover to cover. You voraciously consumed this. I saw you.
I have. It's been my bedtime reading for the last, I have to admit, 2 weeks. So I've really pored over it. And I must say, Tim, I hope you don't mind accepting some praise for your prose, because it really is delightful to read. And you convey not only what's happening to you on your travels, but you also manage to put that into the historical context of, as you said, a swathe of land that has played such an important part in human history. So it really is. It's a terrific read. And if anybody is wondering what to do while we're having some spring rain during the next couple of months, definitely pop out and get a copy of On the Trail of Genghis Khan. If you're not one of those people that likes to carry around something the size of War and Peace, you can get it as an e-book. So,
oh, really?
So
cool.
Don't worry. You don't have to have it as a large tome.
But, Tim, you're also doing some other things, right?
I'm actually launching my book with a special appearance here in Melbourne on the 3rd of October. We're going to have throat singing and traditional Mongolian dancing concert.
Can you throat sing?
No, I definitely can't. But my friend Buku can, and he's from Mongolia. And I'll be going through a presentation, all of the behind-the-scenes look at how the journey was, and some film and slides and a book signing. People can come along. It's at the academic building of RMIT on Swanston Street on the 3rd of October, and you can just, the best way to find it is just jump on to worldexpeditions.com or just Google Tim Cope, World Expeditions Melbourne.
We'll pop those on the Joy website, so joy.org.au/escapepod. You can download this podcast and we'll make sure the links are there for you.
There may be a four-legged appearance for my friend here too.
Mr. Vodka Paws over in the corner.
Vodka Paws is sleeping it off in the studio, I have to say. There's nearly a slight snore coming from that corner of the room.
Well, I'm absolutely fascinated about this whole thing. The book also has lots of graphic images, because it's quite hard to try and fathom the kind of experiences of this broad landscape and the vastness and the emptiness, and how that somehow becomes something much more filling. Yeah, so there's lots of great images for people as well, but also the talk on the 3rd of October, get on down. So we will have those details
and
up on the website.
How are you sustaining your career at the moment, Tim?
It's a combination. I've been very lucky that I've been able to combine my love of writing, which is something I loved doing before I began travelling, film and photography. So the combination of documentaries, books, presentations, guiding trips, it all combines to create a wonderful career, and multifaceted and always challenging.
Yep.
And this is the beginning of quite a big tour. I've got about 12 or 15 cities to go to in the States and Canada, and then UK and Germany. So the interesting thing about my book is that I actually got the contract in the middle of Manhattan at the end of my journey. I kind of arrived there feeling very lost, but in wonderment, and had wonderful meetings with some publishers. And my editor, Anton, he's lived in New York, I've been here, and I wrote it all alone, and then he would just send me critique for each chapter. And it's been a four-year epic, but he laid the gauntlet down and really challenged me to write in a way that was better than I'd ever written.
Well, I can certainly say that it's a great read.
Isn't it?
You really will not put the book down, and you come away just with such an appreciation of your journey and what it could mean to actually live life without being in an urban setting.
Well, strange. I've had to put it down a couple of times. I haven't read as much as Joe has. Joe's finished. But there are a couple of times I put it down where I just had to think to myself, I had to process what I'd read. It was just such a vast departure from where I've travelled, and I've travelled a lot.
And Tim, if somebody actually was interested in being guided by you, would they go to the
worldexhibitions.com?
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with Joy.